Octavian opened the letter. He could not have been far away, and was most likely in the palace, to read Cleopatra's fervent request that she be buried at Antony's side. Instantly he guessed what had happened. He was astounded. In haste, he began to head off, and then, changing his mind, he was flustered, dispatched messengers to investigate for him. They rushed to the mausoleum, where Octavian's guards stood sentry, unperturbed and unsuspecting. Together, they burst through the doors. They were too late. The mischief, Plutarch tells us, had been swift. Cleopatra lay on a golden couch, probably an Egyptian-style bed with lion paws for legs and lion heads at its corners. Majestically and meticulously arrayed in her most beautiful apparel, she gripped in her hands the crook and flail. She was perfectly composed and completely dead, Iris very nearly so at her feet. Lurching and heavy-headed, almost unable to stand, Carmion was clumsily attempting to right the diadem around Cleopatra's forehead. Angrily, one of Octavian's men exploded. "A fine deed this, Carmion!" She had just the energy to offer a parting shot. With a tartness that would have made her mistress proud, she managed, "It is indeed most fine, and befitting the descendant of so many kings," before collapsing in a heap at her queen's side. Carmion's was an epitaph no one could dispute, nor could it be improved upon. Shakespeare used it verbatim. Valor in the unfortunate obtains great reverence, even among their enemies, notes Plutarch. And in Octavian's camp, there was admiration and pity all around. Cleopatra had demonstrated tremendous courage. How she accomplished her final feat is less evident. Octavian was under the impression, or meant to convey the impression, that she had enlisted an asp. Arriving on the scene after his messengers, he attempted to resuscitate Cleopatra. He called in the Psylli, Libyans believed to enjoy a magical immunity to snake venom. By taste, they were said to be able to determine what kind of snake had bitten. By murmuring spells and sucking at the wound, they were said to be able to extract death from an icy corpse. The Psylli who knelt over Cleopatra worked no miracles. The Egyptian queen could not be revived. That was not altogether surprising. Neither Dio nor Plutarch was at all sure of the asp, who surely crept into the story later rather than arriving in Cleopatra's lifetime amid a basket of figs. Even Strabo, who landed in Egypt shortly after her death, was unconvinced. For any number of reasons, Cleopatra was unlikely to have recruited an asp or an Egyptian cobra for the job. A woman known for her crisp decisions and meticulous planning would surely have hesitated to entrust her fate to a wild animal. She had plenty of quicker, less painful options. It was, as well, a little too convenient to be killed by the royal emblem of Egypt. The snake made more symbolic than practical sense. Even the most reliable of cobras cannot kill three women in quick succession, and the asp is a famously sluggish snake. An Egyptian cobra, bristling and hissing and puffing itself up to its 6-foot splendor, could hardly have hidden in a fig basket or remained hidden in one for long. The job was too great and the basket too small. Poison was a more likely alternative, as Plutarch seems to imply with his survey of Cleopatra's experiments. Most likely, she swallowed a lethal drink. The hemlock and opium of Socrates would have done the trick, or applied a toxic ointment. Hannibal had resorted to poison when backed into a corner 150 years earlier. Mithridates had attempted the same. Cleopatra's uncle, the king of Cyprus, had known precisely what to have on hand when Rome had come calling in 58. assuming she died of the same cause as Carmion, assuming she died in the state in which she was discovered, Cleopatra suffered little. There were no shuddering paroxysms, which cobra venom would ultimately have induced. This toxin's effect was more narcotic than convulsive, the death peaceful, swift, and essentially painless. The truth of the matter, Plutarch announces, to centuries of deaf ears, no one knows. Dismissed for nearly 200 years, the snake clings tenaciously to the story. Cleopatra's asp is the cherry tree of ancient history, a convenience, a shorthand, most of all, a gift to painters and sculptors through the centuries. It made poetic sense and good art. So did the naked breast, also not part of the original tale. And the snake multiplied immediately. Horace wrote sharp-toothed serpents into an ode. Virgil, Propertius, and Martial would follow suit. The beast or beasts figure in every early account. Octavian would further clinch the deal by displaying a model of Cleopatra with an asp in his triumph. Not only was the snake a potent symbol of Egypt, where coiled cobras had adorned pharaonic brows for millennia, but snakes crawled all over Isis statues as well. They had insinuated themselves in the Dionysian cult. Iconography aside, it is easy to see what someone is trying to communicate when he pairs a lady with a snake. Alexander the Great's mother, as murderous and maniacal a Macedonian princess who ever lived, kept serpents as pets. She used them to terrify men. Before her came Eve, Medusa, Electra, and the Uranus. When a woman teams up with a snake, a moral storm threatens somewhere. Octavian may have confused the issue for all time with his call to the Psylli. He controlled the historical record every bit as firmly as he was said to have controlled his adolescent sexual urges. Very likely, he sent us off for thousands of years in the wrong direction. He may have done so intentionally. There is an alternate version of the death. It has long been clear that we may be missing something here, that one farce of August 10th could well conceal another, that the greatest deathbed scene in history is perhaps not what it seems. In the earliest prose account, Cleopatra cheated the vigilance of her guards to procure an asp and stage her death. Octavian is vexed, furious that she has slipped through his fingers. He had, however, an immense, dedicated staff. By August, few in Alexandria would have hesitated to cooperate with him, as Cleopatra's steward demonstrated. Octavian was as careless as Cleopatra was naive. The kind of man who marked both the date and the time on his letters was not the kind of man to let a prize captive slip through his fingers. When Octavian left her on August 8th, he may well have deceived Cleopatra into believing he was deceived, and essentially orchestrated her death. He would not have cared to have been outwitted by a woman, unless, of course, the alternative were more damaging. And Cleopatra was as problematic a captive as she had been an enemy. Octavian had attended the triumphs of 46. He had even ridden in one of them. He knew of the sympathy Cleopatra's sister had elicited on that occasion. He had publicly condemned Mark Antony for having paraded Artavasdes in chains. That kind of behavior, Octavian had scolded, dishonored Rome. There was, too, an additional wrinkle in Cleopatra's case. This particular prisoner had been the divine Caesar's mistress. She was the mother of his son. In some eyes, she was a goddess in her own right. She could be trusted to live out her days quietly in some Asian outpost, about as much as could her younger sister. Twice, Cleopatra had tried to kill herself. It was clear that unless guarded carefully, she would sooner or later succeed. Octavian would have been left to calculate which embarrassment was greater, to be outwitted by a woman, or to return to Rome without the villain of the peace. It could be difficult to gauge the occasionally tender sensibilities of his countrymen. Sometimes they met the children of defeated kings with jeers and ridicule. Sometimes those innocents marred the exercise, eliciting tears and discomfort. Cleopatra had been declared a public enemy, but an effigy would serve perfectly well in a triumph, as had effigies of Roman adversaries in the past. While her death reduced the glory a little, it also eliminated a host of complications. Octavian may have preferred to shuffle Cleopatra off the stage in Alexandria than to make a misstep in Rome. He was genuinely terrified that she might destroy her treasure, by no means terrified that she would destroy herself, in which act he may essentially have colluded. Young Dolabella was then but a tool in Octavian's game. It was, after all, unlikely that one of his staff officers would risk a friendship with Cleopatra. And Octavian did not, in fact, leave Alexandria on August 12th, as Dolabella had heatedly warned. He may have delivered the message, possibly even a more ominous one, to hasten the course of events. Both Dio and Plutarch point to Octavian's repeated injunctions that Cleopatra be kept alive rather than to any complicity in her death. That does not mean there was none. A fourth casualty on August 10th, 30, may well have been the truth. The counter-arguments go something like this. Cleopatra had attempted both to starve and skewer herself. Why had Octavian foiled those attempts to torture her with threats about her children? 9 days passed between Antony's death and Cleopatra's. Surely it would have been preferable to have eliminated her at once. She had already sworn to die with Antony after all, and she would have known of Octavian's predicament. She was as aware as he of the sensation her sister had caused. She might have gambled that Octavian would not risk parading her and her half-Roman children through the streets of Rome. Octavian seems truly and uncharacteristically unnerved by the news of Cleopatra's death. He did not make a great deal of the mercy he had shown her, as he might have been expected to have done, and as he usually did. Instead, he boasted in his memoirs that various kings and 9 children of kings had marched, in the course of 3 triumphs, before his chariot. No future historian, even those antipathetic to Octavian, ventures an assertion of complicity, although it could be argued that by then the case was closed, the truth known only to a few in the first place. We are ultimately left chasing our tails. The best that can be said of her last act is that Cleopatra acted heroically in a great set piece that may be, on several counts, ahistorical and is certainly in some part her opponent's invention. The sole consolation is a perverse one. The death of Alexander the Great is well documented and no less a perfect riddle. Plutarch has Octavian torn between 2 emotions on the evening of August 10th. He is both vexed at the death of the woman and in awe of her lofty spirit. In Dio II, Octavian is admiring and sympathetic, if excessively grieved on his own account. His triumph will be less magnificent. While it is unclear who had done so, someone had produced a heroine. Cleopatra's was an honorable death, a dignified death, an exemplary death. She had presided over it herself, proud and unbroken to the end. By the Roman definition, she had at last done something right. Finally, it was to her credit that she had defied the expectations of her sex. Women inevitably win points in Roman histories for swallowing hot coals, or hanging themselves by their hair, or hurling themselves from rooftops, or handing bloody daggers along to their husbands with three quiet words of encouragement, "It isn't painful." Plenty of female corpses litter the Greek stage as well, the difference being that in Greek drama, the women also get the last word. The panegyrics were immediate. In an ode written shortly after her suicide, Horace set out to condemn Cleopatra for her folly and ambition, but wound up eulogizing her. "No craven woman she," he concludes, marveling at the clear mind, the calm countenance, the courage. Cleopatra's final act was arguably her finest one. That was a price Octavian was perfectly happy to pay. Her glory was his glory. The exalted opponent was the worthy opponent. Octavian arranged for Cleopatra to be buried with royal splendor and magnificence. To do otherwise was to risk inciting the Alexandrians, who no doubt mourned their queen publicly, despite the Roman presence. According to Plutarch, Octavian honored also her request to be laid to rest at Antony's side. Iris and the eloquent Carmian received similarly fine burials with their queen. It is unclear if the three were mummified. Their splendid joint monument would have been lavishly and colorfully decorated, as were the royal tombs of Cleopatra's ancestors, with Roman twists in the iconography. By one account, statues of Iris and Carmian stood sentry outside. Plutarch implies that the burial place was in the center of Alexandria, along with those of previous Ptolemies. Octavian ordered the mausoleum to be finished as well, work presumably completed in a subdued city, numb with uncertainty. The Alexandrians were now Roman subjects. That Cleopatra's monument was adjacent to a temple of Isis essentially means it could have been anywhere. The most recent theory is that Antony and Cleopatra's final resting place is 20 miles west of Alexandria, on a sun-bleached hillside in Taposiris Magna, overlooking the Mediterranean. Neither the tomb nor the mausoleum, they were almost certainly separate structures, has been found. Cleopatra was 39 years old and had ruled for nearly 22 years, about a decade longer than had Alexander the Great, from whom she had inherited the baton that she inadvertently passed on to the Roman Empire. With her death, the Ptolemaic dynasty came to an end. Octavian formally annexed Egypt on August 31st. His first year was Cleopatra's last. He started the clock again with August 1st, the date on which he had entered Alexandria. Cleopatra is said to have brought down the curtain on an age, although, of course, from the Egyptian perspective, Antony, too, could be said to have done so. It is easy to forget. He was Cleopatra's undoing, every bit as much as she was his. To the end, Ptolemaic tutors proved fickle. Caesarion got as far as a port on the Red Sea when Rhodon convinced him to return to Alexandria, possibly to negotiate with Octavian in his mother's stead. The ancient world was, at times, an uncomfortably small place. Octavian could afford neither to let his cousin live, nor to exhibit a son of the divine Caesar in a triumph. The name Caesarion alone posed a problem. The much-publicized coming-of-age ceremony did not help. Octavian's men returned the 17-year-old to Alexandria, where they murdered him, possibly having tortured him first. As they posed no real danger, Alexander Helios, Cleopatra Selene, and Ptolemy Philadelphus returned to Rome with Octavian, to be raised by his always amenable sister. They grew up in her large, comfortable household, with Antony and Octavia's daughters, and with Antony's surviving children by his previous marriages. Iotope, Alexander Helios's intended, returned to her family in Media. A year after the death of their mother, Cleopatra's surviving children walked in Octavian's triumph. Surely an awkward event for three youngsters said to be raised as attentively as if they were his own. He later married Cleopatra Selene off to Juba II, who at the age of five had walked in Caesar's African triumph, and was thereafter educated in Rome, where he developed a passion for history. Husband and wife had known similar formations and similar humiliations. The Roman civil wars made orphans of them both. A man of culture, something of a poet, a favorite of Octavian's, Juba was sent with his bride to rule Mauritania. It is today Algeria. Cleopatra's daughter was probably 15 at the time, Juba 22. As a favor to the young royals, Octavian spared Cleopatra Selene's brothers, who may have traveled to Western Africa as well. After the triumph, we lose sight of the two boys forever. On the Mauritanian throne, Cleopatra Selene continued her mother's legacy. Her coins bear her likeness and are inscribed in Greek. Juba's are in Latin. Together, the couple transformed their capital into a cultural and artistic center, complete with a splendid library. Plenty of Egyptian sculpture, including a piece from July 31st, 30, the day before Octavian entered Alexandria, has turned up in the area, where Cleopatra Selene evidently assembled a gallery of Ptolemaic busts. She continued the Isis association and named her son Ptolemy. She kept sacred crocodiles. Cleopatra's only known grandson, Ptolemy of Mauritania, succeeded Juba in A.D. 23. 17 years into his reign, he visited Rome at the invitation of Caligula. Both men descended from Mark Antony. They were half-cousins. The Roman emperor greeted the African king with honors, until Ptolemy one day swept into a gladiatorial show in a particularly splendid purple cloak. Heads turned to Caligula's displeasure. He ordered Ptolemy's murder, an appropriate end to dynasty steeped from the start in blazing, supersaturated color. Footnote. Caligula descended from both Mark Antony, his paternal great-grandfather, and Octavian, his maternal great-grandfather. He posed alternately as a descendant of each, depending on his agenda. It was easy to trip up under his reign when sacrifices to celebrate Antony's overthrow might be objectionable one day, the reluctance to offer sacrifices to Augustus's victory the next. End of footnote. Octavian obliterated all traces of Antony in both Rome and Alexandria. January 14th, his birthday, was deemed an unlucky day on which no public business could be transacted. By Senate decree, the names Mark and Antony were never again to be conjoined. Otherwise, he was discarded, a historical inconvenience. Octavian would mention neither Antony nor Cleopatra by name in his account of Actium. He sentenced several of Antony's close associates to death, Canidius and the Roman senator who supervised Cleopatra's textile mills, chief among them. Those who had sworn to perish with Antony and Cleopatra were, presumably, relieved of the need to see to the job themselves. Other partisans disappeared. The influential high priest at Memphis, who was born the same year as Caesarion and who had remained personally bound to Cleopatra, died, mysteriously, several days before her. It was imperative that no one survive who might exercise authority, rally the people, reassemble Cleopatra's kingdom. Octavian's men collected the pile of Ptolemaic treasure from the palace and exacted fines throughout the city, inventing misdemeanors as they went. Where imagination failed, They simply confiscated two-thirds of a victim's property. It was a polite kind of plunder. The Romans made out handsomely. Octavian removed from Alexandria the fine statuary and precious art that Antony and Cleopatra had pillaged throughout Asia, restoring it, for the most part, to the cities to which it belonged. A few of the finest pieces wound up in Rome, where the best art had long come from the second century sack of Corinth. 17 years after Cleopatra's death, Octavian finished the Caesareum, that Pharaonic and Greek marvel, in his honor. Cleopatra had plenty of partisans, as faithful as had been her ladies-in-waiting, whose devotion was the talk of Alexandria. A servant did not normally die for her mistress. Those who had offered to rise up for their queen remained loyal. Cleopatra had her country's favor. There had been no revolts under her reign. Alexandria must have given itself over to mourning. There were processions and hymns and offerings. The city would have been loud with keening and wails as the women of Alexandria shredded their garments and beat their breasts. On behalf of the native priests, a cleric offered Octavian 2,000 talents to preserve Cleopatra's many statues. She might remain noble, but she was also dead. The offer was too attractive to refuse. It saved Octavian as well from the thorny business of tangling with Isis, who continued to be worshipped for some time. Cleopatra was often indistinguishable from that goddess. Octavian could not very well go around volatile Alexandria toppling religious statuary. Cleopatra's statues and her cult lived on actively for hundreds of years, no doubt reinforced by her steely last stand against the Romans. Octavian did not tarry in Egypt, henceforth a Roman province to which no prominent Roman traveled without express permission. One of the few imperialists in history who did not care to be Alexander the Great, all would have worked out very differently for Cleopatra if he had, he was more invested in raw power than its glorious accessories. He evidenced little interest in Egyptian history, to the dismay of Cleopatra's former subjects, eager to display the remains of her ancestors. Octavian made it known that he had little patience for dead Ptolemies. He paid his respects only to Alexander the Great, removed from his sarcophagus for the visit. The story goes that Octavian accidentally brushed against the body. He may have been strewing flowers, detaching a piece of mummified nose in the process. Susceptible as Octavian was to sunstroke, he went nowhere without his broad-brimmed hat. He could not have much enjoyed the liquid heat of the Alexandrian August. In the fall, he withdrew to Asia. No one profited more from Cleopatra's death than Herod, who hosted the Romans again on their northbound trip. Octavian returned to him his precious palm and balsam groves, and the coastal cities that Antony had appropriated for Cleopatra, supplementing them with additional territories. Herod's kingdom swelled, finally, to dimensions commensurate with his kindnesses. Rome's new favorite among non-Romans, he inherited as well the 400 strapping Gauls who had served as Cleopatra's bodyguard. Nicolaus of Damascus stepped in as his tutor to become his close confidant. He produced a court history for Herod, from which Josephus, a major source for the life of Cleopatra, and himself a mid-career convert to the Roman cause, would work. Octavian left Gallus in charge of Egypt as prefect. He too would discover that the province was difficult to rule. In 29 he subdued the people around Thebes, the common terror of all kings, and that its riches went to one's head. He exceeded his command, commissioned too many statues of himself, inscribed his great deeds on the pyramids, and, indicted by the Senate, wound up a suicide. Almost precisely a year after Cleopatra's death, She paraded in effigy down the streets of Rome in the last and most sumptuous of Octavian's 3 days of triumph. With her, a veritable river of gold, silver, and ivory flowed down the Via Sacra and through the Forum. Dio tells us that the Egyptian procession surpassed all others in costliness and magnificence. After the coffers of gold and silver, the wagons of jewelry, weapons, and art, the colorful placards and pennants, the defeated soldiers marched the prized prisoners, the 10-year-old twins and 6-year-old Ptolemy Philadelphus, in chains. Cleopatra was featured on her deathbed in plaster or paint, along with the asp, who may have started it all. Surrounded by his officers, the purple-cloaked Octavian followed behind. Cleopatra had been wrong in one assessment. Antony was conspicuously missing from the occasion. She was right in another. The only sovereign who did walk in that triumph, an ally of Antony's, was executed soon afterward. The city glimmered with the spoils of Egypt. Tons of Ptolemaic gold and silver, breastplates and tableware, crowns and shields, gem-studded furniture, paintings and statuary had sailed with Octavian, as had several crocodiles. Some have placed a lumbering hippopotamus and a rhinoceros at the triumph as well. Octavian could well afford to be generous, and there were substantial gifts all around. The Egyptian victory was celebrated with particular elan, not only because it could afford to be. There was a civil war to camouflage. Cleopatra's statue remained in the Forum. It was the least Octavian could do for the woman whose golden couches and jeweled pitchers financed his career. Cleopatra allowed him to discharge every one of his obligations. She guaranteed Roman prosperity. So vast were the funds Octavian injected into the economy that prices soared, interest rates tripled. As Dio summed up the transfer of wealth, Cleopatra saw to it that the Roman Empire was enriched and its temples adorned. Her art and obelisks decorated its streets. Soundly defeated, she was nonetheless celebrated in the beauty of a foreign city. With the riches came a rush of Egyptomania. Sphinxes, rearing cobras, sun disks, acanthus leaves, hieroglyphs proliferated throughout Rome. Lotus blossoms and griffins decorated even Octavian's personal study. Cleopatra earned a second backhanded tribute. In her wake, a golden age of women dawned in Rome. High-born wives and sisters suddenly enjoyed a role in public life. They interceded with ambassadors, counseled husbands, traveled abroad, commissioned temples and sculptures. They became more visible in art and in society. They joined Cleopatra in the Forum. No Roman woman would ever attain the exalted status or enjoy the unprecedented privileges granted Livia and Octavia, which they owed to a foreigner, to whom they served as counterweight. Livia compiled a fat portfolio of properties, one that would include lands in Egypt and palm groves in Judea. Octavia would go down in history as the un-Cleopatra, supremely modest, prudent, and pious. Cleopatra got a promotion as well, from pretext to punctuation point. If you were looking for a date for the beginning of the modern world, her death would be the best to fix upon. With her, she took both the 400-year-old Roman Republic and the Hellenistic Age. Octavian would go on to effect one of the greatest bait-and-switches in history. He restored the Republic in all its glory and, as would be apparent within a decade or so, as a monarchy. Having learned from Caesar's example, he did so subtly. Octavian was never a king, always a princeps, or first citizen. For a title that was at once sufficiently grand and free of all monarchical odor, he turned to Cleopatra's former friend, Plancus, the painted sea nymph. Plancus coined the name Augustus to signify that the man formerly known as Gaius Julius Caesar was more than human, that he was precious and revered. There was some irony, in fact, that the West quickly began to resemble Cleopatra's East, the more so as Octavian had advertised Cleopatra as a threat to the Republic, something she had never intended. Around Octavian formed a kind of court. He fell out with nearly every member of his immediate family. The Roman emperors became gods. They had their pictures painted as Serapis, following Antony's Dionysian lead. And professions of austerity aside, the mantle of magnificence passed easily. While Octavian was said to have melted down Cleopatra's fabulous gold tableware, Hellenistic grandeur prevailed. For it is fitting that we who rule over many people, reasoned one of Octavian's advisers, should surpass all men in all things, and brilliance of this sort also tends, in a way, to inspire our allies with respect for us, and our enemies with terror. He counseled Octavian to spare no expense. Rome represented the new luxury market. The artisans and industries followed. Livia had a personal staff of more than 1,000. So impressed was Octavian by Cleopatra's lofty mausoleum that he built a similar one in Rome. Alexandria deserves much credit for Rome's transformation from brick to marble. Octavian died at age 76, at home in his bed, one of the few Roman emperors not murdered by close kin, another Hellenistic legacy. Having ruled for 44 years, twice as long as Cleopatra, he had plenty of time in which to refashion the events that had brought him to power. Footnote. As ever, a capable woman was suspect. It would be whispered that Livia killed him. Curiously, she was said to have done so with poisoned figs. End of footnote. He had, too, cause to note that no high position is ever free from envy or treachery, and least of all, a monarchy. The enemies were bad, but the friends arguably worse. The office, he concluded, was utterly dreadful. The rewriting of history began almost immediately. Not only did Mark Antony disappear from the record, but Actium wondrously transformed itself into a major engagement, a resounding victory, a historical turning point. It went from an end to a beginning. Augustus had rescued the country from great peril. He had resolved the civil war and restored world peace after a century of unrest. Time began anew. To read the official historians, it is as if with his return the Italian peninsula burst, after a crippling, ashen century of violence, into technicolor, as if the crops sat suddenly upright, plump and golden in the fields. Validity was restored to the laws, authority to the courts, and dignity to the Senate, proclaims Velleius, very nearly cataloguing the duties with which Caesar had been meant to contend in 46. Augustus's ego is embedded in the calendar, where it remains to this day, commemorating the fall of Alexandria and Rome's reprieve from a foreign menace. Footnote. The practice of renaming months ended with Tiberius, who, urged to appropriate November, scoffed that all would become highly problematic if there turned out to be 13 Caesars. End of footnote. Calendars of the time acknowledge the date as one on which he freed Rome from a most grievous danger. Cleopatra was particularly ill-served. The turncoats wrote the history. Delius, Plancus, and Nicolaus of Damascus first among them. The years after Actium were a time of extravagant praise and lavish myth-making. Her career also coincided with the birth of Latin literature. It was Cleopatra's curse to inspire its great poets, happy to expound on her shame in a language inhospitable to her and all she represented. Horace wrote exuberantly of Actium. The first to celebrate Octavian's splendid victory, he did so while Cleopatra was still frantically fortifying Alexandria. He celebrates her defeat before it has occurred. Virgil and Propertius were on hand for the Egyptian triumph, by which time both the asp and Cleopatra's pernicious influence were already set in stone. In every reckoning, Antony is made to flee Actium on Cleopatra's account. She helpfully illuminated one of Propertius's favorite points. A man in love is a helpless man, shamefully subservient to his mistress. It is as if Octavian delivers Rome from that ill as well. He has restored the natural order of things. Men ruled women, and Rome ruled the world. On both counts, Cleopatra was crucial to the story. Virgil composed the Aeneid in the decade after Cleopatra's death. He put snakes in her wake, even at Actium. She had no hope of faring well in a work read aloud both to Augustus and Octavia, as were portions of that epic poem. For the rest, her story would be shaped by a Roman she met once in the last week of her life, who elevated her to a perilous adversary, at which altitude thick mists and obscuring myths settled comfortably around her. She counts among the losers whom history remembers, but for the wrong reasons. Footnote. She may well have known Aesop's fable, as the lion said to the man, "There are many statues of men slaying lions, but if only the lions were sculptors, there might be quite a different set of statues." End of footnote. The mythmakers all aligned on one side. For the next century, the Oriental influence and the emancipation of women would keep the satirists in business. Since Cleopatra's death, her fortunes have waxed and waned as dramatically as they did in her lifetime. Her power has been made to derive from her sexuality for obvious reason. As one of Caesar's murderers had noted, how much more attention people pay to their fears than to their memories. It has always been preferable to attribute a woman's success to her beauty rather than to her brains, to reduce her to the sum of her sex life. Against a powerful enchantress, there is no contest. Against a woman who ensnares a man in the coils of her serpentine intelligence, in her ropes of pearls, there should, at least, be some kind of antidote. Cleopatra unsettles more as sage than as seductress. It is less threatening to believe her fatally attractive than fatally intelligent. Menander's 4th-century adage, "A man who teaches a woman to write should recognize that he is providing poison to an asp," was still being copied out by schoolchildren hundreds of years after her death. It also makes a better story. Propertius sets the tone. Cleopatra was, for him, a wanton seductress, the whore queen, later, a woman of insatiable sexuality and insatiable avarice. Dio, a carnal sinner, Dante, the whore of the Eastern kings, Boccaccio, a poster child for unlawful love, Dryden. Footnote. Dante at least places her 7 circles above her brother in hell. Her sin, lust, was against herself. Her younger brother's betrayal was against another. End of footnote. Propertius has her fornicating with her slaves. A 1st-century Roman would assert, falsely, that ancient writers repeatedly speak of Cleopatra's insatiable libido. In one ancient account, she is so insatiable that she often played the prostitute. She is also both so beautiful and toxic that many men bought nights with her at the price of their lives. In the estimation of one 19th-century woman, She was a dazzling piece of witchcraft. Florence Nightingale referred to her as that disgusting Cleopatra. Offering her the movie role, Cecil B. DeMille is said to have asked Claudette Colbert, "How would you like to be the wickedest woman in history?" Cleopatra stars even in a 1928 book called Sinners Down the Centuries. In the match between the lady and the legend, there is no contest. The personal inevitably trumps the political, and the erotic trumps all. We will remember that Cleopatra slept with Julius Caesar and Mark Antony long after we have forgotten what she accomplished in doing so. But she sustained a vast, rich, densely populated empire in its troubled twilight in the name of a proud and cultivated dynasty. She remains on the map for having seduced two of the greatest men of her time, while her crime was to have entered into those same wily and suspicious marital partnerships that every man in power enjoyed. She did so in reverse and in her own name. This made her a deviant, socially disruptive, an unnatural woman. To these, she added a few other offenses. She made Rome feel uncouth, insecure, and poor, sufficient cause for anxiety, without adding sexuality to the mix. For some time, she haunted the ancient imagination, primarily as a cautionary tale. Under Augustus, the institution of marriage took on a new luster, a development that boded poorly for Cleopatra, the destabilizing, domineering homewrecker. She elicited scorn and envy in equal and equally distorting measure. Her story is constructed as much of male fear as fantasy. From Plutarch descends history's greatest love story, though Cleopatra's life was neither as lurid nor as romantic as has been made out. And she became a femme fatale twice over. For Actium to be the battle to beat all battles, she had to be the wild queen plotting Rome's destruction. For Antony to have succumbed to something other than a fellow Roman, Cleopatra had to be a disarming seductress who had already ruined him and would make his ruin still more complete. It can be difficult to say where vengeance ends and homage begins. Her power was immediately enhanced because, for one man's historical purposes, she needed to have reduced another to abject slavery. It is true that she was a dutiful, father-loving daughter, a patriot and protector, an early nationalist, a symbol of courage, a wise ruler with nerves of steel, a master at self-presentation. It is not true that she built the lighthouse of Alexandria, could manufacture gold, was the ideal woman, Gautier, a martyr to love, Chaucer, a silly little girl, Shaw, the mother of Christ. A 7th-century Coptic bishop termed her the most illustrious and wise of women, greater than the kings who preceded her. On a good day, Cleopatra is said to have died for love, which is not exactly true either. Ultimately, everyone from Michelangelo to Jerome, from Corneille to Brecht, got a crack at her. The Renaissance was obsessed with her, the Romantics yet more so. She sent even Shakespeare over the top, eliciting from him his greatest female role, his richest poetry, a full, Antony-less last act, and in the estimation of one critic, a rollicking tribute to guilt-free, middle-aged adultery. Shakespeare may be as much to blame for our having lost sight of Cleopatra the Seventh as the Alexandrian humidity, Roman propaganda, and Elizabeth Taylor's limpid lilac eyes. A center of intellectual jousting and philosophical marathons, Alexandria did not immediately surrender its vitality. It continued as the brain of the Mediterranean world for another century or so. Then it began to dematerialize. With it went legal autonomy for women, the days of suing your father-in-law for the return of your dowry when your insolvent husband ran off and had a baby with another woman were over. After a 5th-century earthquake, Cleopatra's palace slid into the Mediterranean. The lighthouse, the library, the museum have all vanished. The Alexandrian harbor bears no relation to its Hellenistic proportions. The Nile itself has changed course. The city has sunk more than 20 feet. Even the coast of Actium, which Cleopatra must practically have memorized, has changed. Her Alexandria has long been almost entirely invisible, either underwater or buried beneath a teeming city that has largely forgotten its Hellenistic chapter. Ptolemaic culture evaporated as well. A great deal that Cleopatra knew would be forgotten for 1,500 years. A very different kind of woman, the Virgin Mary, would subsume Isis as entirely as Elizabeth Taylor has subsumed Cleopatra. Our fascination with Cleopatra has only increased as a result. She is all the more mythic for her disappearance. The holes in the story keep us under her spell, and she continues to unsettle. All the issues that disrupt the dinner table, that go to our heads like snake venom, combine in her person. 2,000 years after she taunted Octavian with a very costly bonfire, nothing enthralls so much as excessive good fortune and devastating catastrophe. We still fight the battle of East and West, still lurch as uneasily as did Cicero between indulgence and restraint. Sex and power continue to combust in spectacular ways. Female ambition, accomplishment, authority, trouble us as they did the Romans, for whom Cleopatra was more a monster than a marvel, but undeniably a little of both. 2,000 years of bad press and overheated prose, of film and opera, cannot conceal the fact that Cleopatra was a remarkably capable queen, canny and opportunistic in the extreme, a strategist of the first rank. Her career began with one brazen act of defiance and ended with another. What woman, what ancient succession of men was so great? Demands the anonymous author of a fragmentary Latin poem, which positions her as the principal player of the age. Boldly and bodily, she inserted herself into world politics with wide-reaching consequences. She convinced her people that a twilight was a dawn, and with all her might, struggled to make it so. In a desperate situation, she improvised wildly, then improvised afresh, for some, a definition of genius. There was a glamour and a grandeur to her story well before either Octavian or Shakespeare got his hands on it. Hers was an exhilarating presence. Before she sent Plutarch many pages out of his way, she had the same effect on his countrymen. From our first glance of her to the last, she dazzles for her ability to set the scene. To the end, she was mistress of herself, astute, spirited, inconceivably rich, pampered, yet ambitious. In her adult life, Cleopatra would have met few people she considered her equal. To the Romans, she was a stubborn, supreme exception to every rule. She remains largely incomparable. She had plenty of predecessors, few successors. With her, the age of empresses essentially came to an end. In 2,000 years, only one or two other women could be said to have wielded unrestricted authority over so vast a realm. Cleopatra remains nearly alone at an all-male table, in possession of a hand both flush and flawed. She got a very good deal right, and one crucial thing wrong. It is impossible to fathom how she could have felt at the end of the summer of 30, as Octavian closed in as it became more and more clear that there were to be no further reversals of fortune, no more brilliantly salvaged futures, that she and Egypt were this time plainly lost. "What is it to lose your country? A great suffering?" a queen asks her son in Euripides. "The greatest, even worse than people say," he replies. The fear and fury must have shattered Cleopatra as she realized she was to become the woman who destroyed the Egyptian monarchy, as a 3rd century AD chronicler has it. For her monumental loss, there were no consolations, including, assuming she believed in one, a brilliant afterlife. Acknowledgements. I have thus endeavored to sum up the evidence upon the case as fairly as I can, and the result seems to be that the world must vibrate in a state of uncertainty as to what was the truth, Boswell concludes, of Richard Savage, proffering hope to generations of biographers. A number of scholars substantially reduced the Hellenistic vibrations, fielding questions that ranged from the elementary to the outlandish to the unanswerable. For their time, wisdom, and patient good humor, I am grateful to Roger S. Bagnall, Mary Beard, Larissa Bonfante, the late Lionel Casson, Mustafa L. Abadi, Bruce W. Fryer, Norma Goldman, Mona Hagog, O. E. Caper, Andrew Meadows, William M. Murray, David O'Connor, Sarah B. Pomeroy, John Swanson, Dorothy J. Thompson, and Branko von Oppen. I owe Roger Bagnall additional thanks for his close reading of the manuscript. Any remaining inaccuracies are my own. For help with and in Alexandria, I am indebted to Terry Garcia, Jean-Claude Golvin, Nimet Habachi, Walla Hafez, Mona Hagog, Zahi Hawass, Kate Hughes, Hisham Hussein, William Larish, Mohammed Abdel Maksoud, Magda Sala, and Marion Wood, Jack A. Josephson, Shelby White, and the American Numismatic Society's Rick Wichonke kindly helped to locate or identify images. It is a pleasure, finally, to acknowledge my admiration for the matchless Michael Peach, publisher extraordinaire, for his colleagues at Little Brown. At every stage, they have set the gold standard. In particular, I owe thanks to Mario Pulici, Vanessa Karen, Liz Garriga, Tracy Williams, Heather Fain, Heather Rizzo, and Betsy Urig. Jane Yaffe Kemp read these pages sensitively and copied it ruthlessly. It has been a privilege to work with Eric Simonoff, whose enthusiasm for this project has, at times, exceeded even my own. At William Morris, I am grateful as well to Jessica Allman for shepherding book and author along. For research and translation assistance, I owe debts to Karina Attar, Matthew J. Boylan, Raffaella Cribiori, Kate Dollos, Sebastian Heath, Inger Kuhn, the indefatigable Tom Pushniak, and Claudia Rader. At the New York Society Library, Brandy Tombosco worked her customary interlibrary loan magic. I'm grateful as well to the staff of the University of Alberta's Rutherford Library and to the New York Public Library, as much a monument to civilization as was the ancient Library of Alexandria. For sound advice, kind words, and caffeine, I've leaned on many indulgent friends, but most heavily upon Wendy Belsberg, Liz Bensley, Alex Mays Birnbaum, Judy Casson, Byron Dubell, Anne Eisenberg, Benita and Colin Eisler, Ellen Feldman, Patty Foster, Harry Frankfurt, Aza Carrara, Mitch Katz, Suad Kriska, Carmen Marino, May Meave and Howard Medwed, Helen Rosenthal, Andrea Versenyi, Meg Wolitzer, and Strauss Zelnick. Eleanor Lippman remains the most discerning, generous, and articulate of first readers. On every level, she has enhanced these pages and their author's life. I would be lost without her. For miracle working, a category that includes producing a pencil out of thin air, comparing 2,000-year-old currencies, scuba diving in the Alexandrian harbor, and equally sharing an address with a writer, I owe an incalculable debt to Marc de la Bruyère. He makes the last line easiest, as none of the preceding ones would have been written without him. This has been an Hachette audio production of Cleopatra, A Life, written by Stacy Schiff, read by Robin Miles, produced and directed by Amber Fairweather, recorded by Tommy Herron, post-production by Eve Seltzer. Cleopatra is also available in print from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 2010 by Stacy Schiff. Audio production copyright and published 2010 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Except as permitted under the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, no part of this production may be reproduced, distributed, or transmitted in any form or by any means, or stored in a database or retrieval system without the prior written permission of the publisher.